You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Happy New Year! It's crazy to say that because we're recording this in December, but we'll be releasing this out on the Patreon on January 1st. So happy 2025, everybody. It's going to be a crazy year ahead in America and perhaps all places, but we're going to nerd out and have fun and create safe spaces because that's what we're here to do. Launching the new year on the Patreon channel, we are beginning with a character that I hate. And that is the character of the X-Cutioner. First of all, the name doesn't work. The phonetics are weird. This is a bizarre character with some weird ties to X-Men history. And I chose this one just because I needed to figure out who he was in my brain. And I'm so excited to invite two friends that I love to nerd out with from real life, because we've all met in person at least once. And I've had you on the show or been on before. Let me welcome my friends Sean and Num One. Sean is a first-time visitor to Grandma Good Lane. Sean, do you want to tell everybody your pronouns and a little about yourself?
Sure. I like to go by he, they. I've been an X-Men fan ever since I was little. Actually, I own an X-Men annual that we're talking about today where we meet the X-Cutioner, which I've always hated the name. And you can find me talking about X-Men movies and cartoons on Solving for X, an X-Men Task podcast.
Over with your delightful friend Kevin, I got to come on and talk all about X-Men Evolution, which I was a virgin to completely. You guys took my X-Men Evolution virginity, and it was weird.
It was very weird.
Weirdest threesome I've ever had.
You're welcome. I'm proud.
Let me also welcome my dear friend Num One back to the show. Hi, Num One. It's great to see you.
Hi. My name is Num One. My pronouns are they, them. I am an X-Men, specifically Storm cosplayer, and I'm so happy to be back.
You guys met at the Uncanny Experience, although you may not have directly met. We were all there together. What a wonderful time that was. I can't wait for this next July. Are you both going to be going again?
Yes.
That's the plan.
Okay. I really look forward to it. It's such a wonderful gathering of queer friends. I had to leave that show multiple times and like feel emotional for a while. Like it just was so wonderful to be there with everybody. Like joy overload. It was really lovely. I'm an empath. I have to like turn off those receptors sometimes. And like that show was really lovely. I had a great time. We're recording this in a crazy political climate. And again, we're going to be releasing this right at the start of the new year. We have no idea what's on our horizons. But as queer friends and allies, we just get to come nerd out and have a good time. I would love to hear your initial thoughts on the Executioner. Reading a character front to back from their perspective is such a crazy journey, and it's why I love making this Patreon channel so much, because I get to look from a perspective I wouldn't normally look. The Executioner is a complex character. He doesn't seem to have a lot of consistency in his appearances. He shows up in 1993, and then every once in a while, he's part of that lexicon of like characters that someone will pull in for a story, but his motivations kind of seem to change. There's also that crossover called The Executioner's Song that has nothing to do with this guy. And I think that's the main reason he annoys me so much, because he's not part of the crossover that's named for him. Yeah. What are your initial takes on the things about The Executioner you like or dislike?
So for me, I like the idea of this, of his like his look, right? Initially, when you meet him, you're thinking, oh, he's like hunting mutants, this human who's like collaborated with all this tech and with other questionable heroes and things to go hunt down mutants who he deems to be criminals and need to be like extinguished, or villains in the sense that like no one has actually handled in an extreme way.
It's giving a little bit of that like rogue cop vibe, right? Like this person slipped through the justice system, so now I'm gonna hunt them down myself is the, yes, the vibe he's trying to give off. But really, yes, he's a fucking asshole.
Then, like, also, like, it's so weird when like he shows up and it's just like random at times. Then, like you said, like the Executioner song had nothing to do with him. Expecting him to show up, it has nothing to do with him at all. Visually, when I was reading as a like younger teenager, I'm like, oh, this isn't interesting. And then I was kind of let down. And like you said, there's such inconsistency with his writing that it's like, I don't know what to do with him. Then he shows up in X-Men 97 and you're like, okay, this is a problem.
Well, then he's the Friends of Humanity asshole who's like shooting Magneto in the court. He's the one that takes Storm's powers. He's very anti-mutant bigot there in a different way.
So they kind of take him and shift him over Elaine, I feel like, which I feel like if he was had been created now, that would have been what he was his purpose was for. But I don't know. Like, I enjoy the idea of the character because it presents a larger question of this idea that, you know, people are redeemable because he doesn't see them that way. But also, like, when he shows up in the annual, it's like, he's already dying. So, like, you're not really, like, doing the thing you think you're doing.
So, if he's the hero version of that rogue cop, there's the guy who, like, raped the girl or killed the kid and got away with it. So, this is the guy that sneaks into your house and kills you afterward, which is very Punisher style. But he has a little bit of, like, a dark villain bend to him. He's the guy that he will assume you're guilty until you prove you're innocent. But you got to prove you're innocent while he has the blade against your throat. And you've got 3 seconds to convince me, otherwise I will cut you. He's almost, he'll run away if you overpower him, but he's a very, I don't know, he's very inconsistent in his way. He gets way over his head a bunch of times. Sean, what are your thoughts on the Executioner's design?
I do like his design. He looks cool. I like the idea that he's amassed these weapons from all over the X-Men history. He's taken them from Fred Duncan, who was a trusted friend of Xavier. So that's a cool aspect of him, but I have similar feelings in that he's not the most exciting villain. I also, I'm really glad you brought up executioners. I always said executioner as a youngster because there's no E. It doesn't make sense. And he's not an executioner song. I don't know. I do like the fact that he like waffles on his beliefs because I think that shows that when you hate indiscriminately, like you don't know exactly what you're hating until you actually need it. So the fact that he kind of has changed his stance multiple times. And like you said, he tries to prove you guilty at the end of a blade. Like it shows that he's learning. And as you learn, you accept other people. So I do like that aspect of him.
This is one of those guys, if I asked a group of X-Men fans to list like 50 X-Men villains, everyone's going to go Magneto, Mystique, the Brood, right? Sentinels. And then somewhere in like number 45 or 46, you're going to think, oh wait, yeah, there's the Executioner. Like he'll make that top 50. He's well known enough to do it. But also you'd be kind of, I'd be like, what's your favorite Executioner story? And you're like, I don't know if I remember any. I feel like he's that kind of villain. He first shows up, there was the thing Marvel did in 1993 where every book that had an annual had to introduce a new character. And they had little trading cards that they introduced with them in the back. A lot of these characters aren't very resonant, but this is the same year that Adam X the Extreme showed up, which also tells you where we're at in history. The Executioner shows up wearing like an Executioner hood. It's very, you know, the guy gets taken up to get his head chopped off and the crowd has gathered around and they pull that like long hood down. But he almost gives off a little bit of like bird vibe. There's a little bit of like a Shi'ar energy almost about the way the hood kind of looks like a like black or gray on black where there's a little bit of like a crow feel to it. And then kind of like a chainmail and he carries a bunch of bizarre weapons around.
It gives like beak.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And like, which is so interesting to me because like when you think like executioner or you think like, you know, this harbinger of death, like I'm thinking, oh, more skeleton maybe. I don't know. Like something maybe a little spookier because like, I don't know. I'm not like terrified of his look.
We don't see a lot of executioners in fiction, but like the one that comes to mind for me is like Disney's Robin Hood, which I grew up watching, where they take Robin Hood up and the executioner's got the hood off. He's got to escape, right? Like there's that kind of vibe to him. He's an interesting visual. I think that's almost my favorite thing about this character is just what the visual of him is.
But like it seems like almost like a hodgepodge of like a bunch of different things almost because he's collaborating with so many different like weapons and like styles or like even the Shi'ar stuff. So like it seems kind of like he's kind of like combined all of these different things, which is why it seems kind of hard to like nail down one specific look for him. So I think it technically works with the character in the sense of like, oh, I pulled like this from this thing and this from this other thing and this, you know, thing, and then I put them all together. So it's not like a uniform look, but it is very like, oh, I know where all of these things came from.
So there's basically three sections to today's conversation. We have the early section of his history, we have his stuff with the Gambit series, and then we have the new guy that comes in later. And the new guy's way worse than the old guy. Second verse, same as the first, a little bit louder and a whole lot worse for that guy, right? Like he's a lot. We first meet the Executioner. His name is Carl Denti in X-Men Annual 17 by Scott Lobdell and Jason Pearson. We're in a fictional South American country. There's a city called San Miguel, and the character Tower, who is a very queer-coded early X-Factor villain, his name is Edward Pasternak, and he dresses in pink and grows real big and punches things. And he's living in this town, like, I don't know, threatening to kill, like, a local woman, and the executioner attacks him and violently murders Tower here. And, you know, Tower kind of deserved it, but I don't know if that's the end he deserved. And the executioner is boasting how he's already killed a bunch of mutants, and he's, like, taking down people who deserve it. We then see him closing in on the dying mastermind. Now, Jason Wingard has caught the legacy virus. And this is a really fascinating issue for Jason, who is trying to find peace with his death as he's like trapped the X-Men and Jean in like a series of illusions where he's ultimately trying to like let go of this mortal coil. You know, it's a really interesting piece. But as he's doing this, we have the executioner kind of stalking. The X-Men end up scanning the executioner. They realize he has weapons that are coded to the Shi'ar, the Zanox, and even to the Sentinels. The man himself is not a mutant. He also has a Factor 3 force field. Now, Factor 3 back in the Silver Age is that crazy story that we covered written by Roy Thomas, where there's that alien mutant master who's trying to conquer humanity by driving mutants and humans to war, and he's going to rule their remains. The Zanox is the end of the Silver Age, where Professor X has to stop the alien invasion after pretending he's dead for a long time. So these are some deep digs into Silver Age history, which is a lot of fun. As the executioner scales a mountain, he mutters to himself, "Carl, you're an idiot. You should be in an office in old J. Edgar's building in D.C. Instead, you're scaling the side of a mountain in Scotland. Hope you appreciate this, Fred Duncan, wherever you are. Not that I owe my former mentor a great deal. If he hadn't spent years stockpiling every weapon or device in some way related to the X-Men, from a Shi'ar Psylance to the prototype Sentinel's propol units, I'd never have been in a position to avenge his death. That old guy let his respect for the X-Men blind him to the very real threat that some mutants represent." So he ends up battling Colossus and Archangel, and he wins the fight, which is crazy. And then he narrowly survives when Storm attacks. Yay, Storm! But with Mastermind dies of natural causes, Executioner just teleports away. So let me provide a little bit of relevance quickly. Fred Duncan is a character. I have an episode about him. Fred Duncan's a character from the very earliest X-Men days. He's an X-Men ally running the FBI's like Bureau of Mutant Affairs, basically. He shows up a handful of times and then just disappears forever. And then we get a random line of dialogue in one place that was like, he was killed by a mutant. This guy's story has never been told. And I've literally written the book. Like, I have a bunch of stories I want to publish someday with Marvel if they'll let me. But I've written the Fred Duncan story, which is what led me to do this executioner thing. I'm like, how are these two tied together? We get the idea that Duncan somehow stockpiled a database of like alien weapons. And Carl Denti, his shit like sidekick at the FBI, has like now appropriated them and created this villainous identity. Sean, did you have thoughts on this first appearance?
I would be remiss to not say this, but like, I found the art very strange. Like, sometimes really good and sometimes very strange. Like, I feel like Archangel looks like Riff Raff from from Rocky Horror Picture Show. But the story itself, I think this has some really like kick-ass moments in it. Like, he kind of leaves Colossus with that pink slash through his face, which it was crazy to see, like, wow, this guy took down Colossus. The artwork with Storm like fighting Executioner, and like she makes a lightning strike that hits his shield and makes a bubble around him. Like, I remember thinking Executioner is a really dangerous villain from the way he's taken down some of these big X-Men, but then he can't fully stand against Storm because she's too damn powerful. She's Storm.
When he first attacks the tower in San Miguel and there's that woman who's in danger, the captions give us kind of a little pathos on this guy. It says, they'll talk about the stranger, how he seemed less interested in saving the life of a young woman than he was in taking the life of the mutant who'd been tormenting her. Some will hail him as a savior, an armored guardian who appeared to them in their darkest hour. Others will insist he was a demon, a monster cloaked in the form of a man. Still others will recall little more than the smell of burnt flesh, the sight of a smoldering husk that was, if nothing else, a human being before the stranger's arrival. So it's kind of a scary intro for him, but then, I don't know, he falls down real fast.
Yeah, he does.
Someone, did you have thoughts on that first issue?
I think that it was very interesting that we're getting a lot of dialogue from him as the like character. We're hearing a lot of his like thoughts and like getting a lot of information about why he's doing what he's doing. I agree, like, he was putting the X-Men to work when Archangel and Colossus are like trying to like battle him. They don't think he's a big deal, and he proves very quickly that he is. And then of course Storm shows up and is like, this is not what we're doing. But I think that like he also recognizes too, like, when he is outmatched, attached, which is why he leaves, which is so interesting to me that, like, he's like, oh, this is a problem now. I gotta go.
It's given real, like, white nationalist energy, really.
Yeah. And, like, honestly, like, it's like, oh, okay, like, I can take these guys. Like, I can handle it. Oh, nope, never mind. This is a bad idea. I gotta go. Like, I'll figure it out later. But it's so interesting to me, like, it feels like sometimes, like, his idea, his concept, like, what he wants to do can come from a good place. But, like, then again, like, in the beginning, when it's, like, this woman who he should, like, be protecting and, like, saving, like, that's not why he's there. He's not there to actually save anyone. It's more like he's there to just, like, punish and kill. So
it cracks me up. Well, first of all, after he kills Tower, again, just slowing this down a little bit, like, the burning body of Tower's in the road, and the woman who's been attacked says, "Señor, gracias." And he says, "Thank you for taking another man's life. I'm afraid I can't accept your gratitude, but I can make you a promise. I will never forsake humanity the way humanity forsook me," which we don't even know what that means. "So please don't look at me with your eyes full of fear. You see, I only kill mutants, and then only mutants who kill first." Like, he's trying real hard to get, like, a soundtrack and, like, a Punisher vibe going. I also love the idea of him, like, styling himself. He, like, he has the black cape and hood, and then he's, like, adorns his head with, like, some, like, little crown style jewelry. There's, like, he's like, "Oh, ooh, look, this looks pretty." He's an interesting character. I don't know. I don't like him much, but I think he's interesting. Num One, will you tell me about his next couple of appearances?
Okay, so we see him next in Uncanny X-Men 310. He is piggyback on Cable's body slide, in which he had been tracking. He then teleports into the X-Mansion and, in activating his cloaking device, stays hidden. Thinking of the dossiers he's inherited from Duncan after Duncan died, Executioner tries to kill Emma Frost, who has been in a coma, but Cyclops and Cable attack him and he goes running. Next, we see him in X-Men 11. He's in a secret chamber under the federal building where he's thinking about how Duncan had been his hero. So this person who he'd gotten all of these, you know, weapons and things from, he is reflecting on that. But his trust of mutants has been displaced. He decides to go after Rogue for the recent death of Cody Robbins, who was, I believe, her first love.
But he died recently in that Rogue limited series that took place just before this.
But she's been hanging out with X-Man, Nate Gray. And just as he, you know, gets his ass kicked a little bad again, he teleports away.
He calls himself a pack rat at one point. He's just, like, gathered all this alien weaponry. The fact that he initially is able to kick the X-Men's asses while going after Tower and Mastermind, but suddenly he's, like, breaking into their mansion. Okay, so Uncanny X-Men 310, he feels like they're harboring Emma Frost, who's in a coma, but he still wants to murder this woman who he considers a criminal, which is fair.
I mean, at that point, I think he was thinking about, like, the fact that she had let all of her students die, and he was holding her responsible for that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So he fights Cyclops and Cable there. He's also able to, like, piggyback on Cable's tech, which is crazy. And then the X-Men battle, he hears about Cody Robbins dying and is like, "I gotta hold this woman, Rogue, accountable." The targets he's choosing is really interesting to me, and you almost wonder what this guy's getting up to, like, behind the scenes. Both of these appearances are fun. I mean, it's some good little superhero romps. Did you enjoy reading those, Num One?
I enjoy more of this, like, conflict with Emma Frost at the time, because she's in the coma, then, you know, we're dealing with all the stuff with her and Iceman and everything else going on, I think, around the same time, right? And so, like, for me, it's like, I was more focused on, like, why are they choosing to do the things they're doing? Because initially when you meet her, she is a villain, right? And then he shows up to kind of put her down at a time when she's her most vulnerable. And it goes back to, like, this idea that I have of, like, questioning people's, you know, capability of redemption. Like, the X-Men are protecting her because they know, like, she's capable of change and good, you know, with, you know, what she's trying to do for those students, right? She, you know, left the Hellfire Club and, you know, was trying to do good. But I don't know. I think that for me, it was more of like, my focus is on the other stuff than him running around being a menace.
He's a story device in some ways, right? In one context, yeah. He is Cyclops and Cable in that issue where he fights them. They're just barely, like, reunited in some ways. Like, this is recently after Cyclops has learned that Cable's his son. So they get to fight this guy off together. And then Rogue, you know, dealing with her own guilt and, like, X-Man getting used to this world and its complicated ethics. Then we have him in Gen X, and this is where it starts to get weird. We have a particular type of story, and then he goes after Skin, of all people. Sean, tell us about the Gen X appearance. words.
Sure. So he appeared in Gen X 16 and 17. He's going after Skin for the murder of Angelo Espinosa. We know something he doesn't know, who was reported dead, but now Skin was using his name in Generation X. So he soon realizes that Skin is a perfect DNA match for Espinosa, but he hunts him anyway. So this is the guy, but I'm going to still hunt him. He hunts him down in a room like full of carnival masks, and Skin makes Denti realize he might be wrong. No, that isn't true. I only did what I had to do. Somebody has to protect the innocent. I didn't toss away 20 years of service to this country just to become a murderer. I stand for something. That's what Denti says to him, and then Skin promptly murders him. Skin kills Denti.
Skin is an interesting character. He's a Latino character from the barrio in Los Angeles, and his origin, I think it's a lot of Ish fans haven't looked at Generation X One Half. It's kind of an obscure story. Even if you read Gen X, you may not have read that, where we see some of his past. There's like a drive-by shooting and his powers manifest, and like there's a homeless guy that tries to steal his wallet, but like that guy ends up exploding and he has Angelo's ID on him. So like Angelo is declared legally dead. And now, you know, so now Denti's coming after him in this issue. Skin doesn't get a lot of love in the comics, which is interesting because I think he's got some potential, but it's a really, I don't know, Denti's portrayal here, like going after a teen, really changes things for me. Like I didn't like the character before, but now I fucking hate him. Numan, do you have Skin thoughts? That's a weird question.
That's a gross question. What's wrong with you, Chad?
I don't have like specific thoughts on Skin because, like you said, like even reading Generation X, like I didn't read Point Five, but I do think that like this questioning of, you know, now suddenly like, I don't want to become a murderer, but this entire time you've been killing people outside of the law, outside of, you know, like you've been hunting down and killing people. Yes, who are questionable, yes, who possibly might deserve it, but like you've already kind of crossed that line already. Is it that you don't want to become a murderer of innocence? Because then it's like, I don't know, that's a weird tangent, sorry, but for Skin specifically, I don't know, it's just okay.
Gen X 17 is framed really interesting. It's that Chris Bacala or Bacciolo art, but there's like it looks like it's like a three ring circus kind of energy. Stan Lee's like narrating the battle as they like battle among stripes, like big top kind of energy. And again, Executioner gets a lot of like deep thoughts about like his cause against fighting mutants. And I don't know, he's interesting in this one. His defeat here is also interesting. They go in like a hall of mirrors and Skin like tricks him and is like really justifying, like, dude, you don't understand my past, you don't come from where I've come from. Then like Skin really kicks his ass at the end and he again has to retreat. So he beats Colossus but gets beat up by Skin, which is great actually.
Yeah.
And then I'll cover this part quickly, but it's one of the bigger Carl Denti stories. There's a run in Punisher in the late 90s. Everything's trying to be X-Men at this point. The X-Men are selling so huge. There's a run in Punisher where Punisher is fighting like the Friends of Humanity and the Mutant Liberation Front and the Executioner's here and like George Washington Bridge is here and William Conover, that old preacher from the Claremont stories that is like pro-mutant. So there's a bunch of mutant content in this. And again, I don't know if a lot of fans have read this. It's in Punisher Volume 3 toward the end. So I'll recap 12 through 16, just the Executioner part really quickly. His mask is way more beaked here. So there's a five-part story called Total Extinction, which is not the Executioner nor the Extinction Agenda, but we just have that X hyphen stinction or tinction part here again. This is a John Ostrander story with art by Tom Lyle. So preacher William Conover has been pro-mutant and now he's being targeted, and Humanity's Last Stand is here, which has ties to the Trask family. There's a guy named Deadeye who's pretending to be a mutant, and Conover ends up like testifying at some congressional committees, and Carl Denti, who we see out of his mask here, I think for the first time, he's got a mustache and like gray temples and glasses. He says he's there to protect the preacher, who has had a lot of death threats directed at him. But S.H.I.E.L.D. agent Kimberly Taylor is here, and you know it's the 90s because Kimberly's K-Y-M. Kimberly. And she is there to protect him as well. Deadeye attacks. Punisher intervenes, so Executioner gets to meet the Punisher. Denti is like super frustrated, like, I have to keep a secret identity this whole time. So there's a point where he pretends to get knocked out so he can change into the Executioner, and then he murders Deadeye on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Now there's more to it than this. It's not super important in the long run of things, but we see this guy kind of balancing the FBI and vigilante sides in a different way in this story. He's like trying to live his cover identity as like a good agent, which is giving very, what's that show on HBO about like corrupt cops? True Detective. It's like very True Detective energy in a way, where he's like trying to maintain one type of identity while sneaking out in a hood at night to murder people. So he does get to kill a human guy pretending to be a mutant here. And then we get to see some of his complex interactions. This is one of those people who has like a really high personal ethical standard for himself, but he's like justified what those ethics mean. Like, it's okay for me to do this. He's a murderer with a code kind of energy in some ways. Again, rather unlikable, but there is a lot of interesting content in this Punisher run. Did either of you get to take a look at this one?
I haven't. But
it's way like more obscure.
Is it? I like the way they explore, though, the fact that like most villains don't care if you know who they are, but he has to hide behind his mask because I feel like that shows that he's so unsure his own ethical code that he has to like separate Carl Denti from Executioner and do everything that's bad or killing with that mask on. So that way he separates from himself.
I mean, he's a serial killer. He's Dexter. Mm-hmm. He has a code, and what his code is fucking mutants. And we don't know enough about his past to give it a lot of relevance. Okay, I'll cover this part because I've done a lot in this series already and it's super complicated. Gambit Volume 3 is a really long run by Fabian Nicieza involving about 47 really complicated plots that are all weaving in and out of each other, including the mysteries around Gambit's birth, the Black Womb Project, Kandra, the Thieves Guild, and there's literally a future version of Gambit from another timeline who has like burned out his planet and is now hopping from world to world to stop other Gambits. So there's a guy called the New Sun deciding if our Gambit is a threat, and there's a bunch of people working for him, including a woman named Fontanelle, who I really love, who is this weird, like, sexy, kinky old dream lady, like hopping around throughout this whole book trying to figure out secrets on Gambit. There's a bunch of shit going on, and there's a bunch of recurring characters. Executioner plays a relatively large role in this series, so Nicieza is really trying to do something with him. Steve Skros does a lot of the art here. So I'll cover this quickly just so we can talk it through, and then let's talk about the relevant concepts. In Gambit Volume 3, Number 1, the story is called Man of Steel, S-T-E-A-L, ha ha ha. And Carl Denti, the FBI agent, has been sent to supervise an archaeological dig overseas for some fucking reason, and there's a girl named Sekhmet Conaway and her father Anwar Anubar, and they have found an ancient temple belonging to Saul, the external, the old dragon guy that's like one of the most ancient mutants, and it contains celestial technology. And Carl Denti helps dig up a sarcophagus from the site, but Gambit steals it and then fights the executioner there. Because look, the executioner's magically over here. It's like when Peter Parker disappears, like, Spider-Man, what are you doing in Africa? So Denti, or Executioner, has Gambit cornered at one point, but Gambit charges up a piece of gum and blows Denti out of the side of a truck. This is a wild story already. In issue 2, we see the Executioner recruit 3 people who've been fired from a company called Elysian Enterprises after they had a fight with Gambit, and then he sends them after Gambit. There's a bunch of these weird little foes. So rather than fighting Gambit himself, he gives these guys, their names are Mariah Ellenthrope, Cosmo Stephanopoulos, and Jack Farley. And they're weird characters that interweave through this series as well. In issue 4, he dresses these 3 flunkies in like some alien gear out of his like secret stash of alien gear. And he announces a plan to use Rogue to lure Gambit in. So he really is fucking after Gambit at this point. Like he fucking hates him. In issue 5, we get him narrating. And we start to see a lot of him like balancing that dichotomy of being a federal agent who also likes to hunt down mutants. So reading a couple of his thought bubbles here. It wasn't until I'd put in 10 years at the Bureau that I achieved the security clearance necessary to obtain the truth. They say the truth shall set you free. They lied. It has trapped me for my entire life. I guess we all lie to ourselves a little to hide the things we can't bear to deal with. Accepting the truth about the people you love is the first step toward reconciling the differences between who you are and who you want to be. And now he's 43 years old, and he's thinking about how his life was ruined at 12. So here's all the answers we get about him. You ready? He captures Rogue Rogue sets a trap in a Stargate that only Gambit can pass through. And then Gambit battles the three flunkies, Farley, Ellen, Thrope, and Stephanopoulos. And then he fights the Executioner himself. We see Denti at one point thinking how Rogue is cute and how he needs to work on his own self-image, which is, I don't know, this guy's inner world is weird. He starts to realize how much Gambit loves Rogue. And here's his thoughts. For honor, I understand. For justice, even for revenge. I've served my entire life for all three purposes. But for love, until today, I couldn't even pretend to understand the depths one could fall to for height or the heights one could reach for that. I realize that LeBeau and Rogue have gone to both extremes. I'm the poorer for not having understood that going into this and for never having done it myself. He gets defeated with his own weapons. His allies want to help them, but he just kills all three of those people so that they will never learn his secrets. And then here's the big one. We get his last thought bubble. It will pause here for a minute. My father wasn't killed by friendly fire. His lieutenant did it, point blank from behind, because my father had shot his own men for refusing to follow his orders, because his orders were not in the cause of honor or justice, not even revenge. He was a heroic man. He came from a long tradition of heroic men. He strove to make his country and the world a better place. He was a lie. He had lost control of himself, of his sense of place. And for all I have done, how am I any different, any better? My world shatters around me, all the pieces falling apart. Even that is a lie. It's not my world. It's a long dead space station in deep space. Expose the lie for what it is before you die. Do it. What is my fear? What is my truth? Simple. I've lived my entire life in the belief of law and order. When law and order restricted federal agent Carl Denti from fulfilling his beliefs, he created the Executioner. When the Executioner failed to fulfill those beliefs, I created an excuse named Remy LeBeau. As both Denti and Executioner, I have violated all of the beliefs I held so dear. I have broken laws, defied order. Denti would arrest me. Now I have committed murder. Executioner would kill me. Imprisoned by the truth, the hull collapses and the vacuum of space rushes in to greet me. For both of us, justice is served. Happy birthday to me.
So dramatic she is.
Okay, we get a lot of this weird man's weird interior world. What are your thoughts on this story about his father, first of all? Number one, I know you have feelings.
I'm annoyed. Okay, so you understand that your father was killed because he was asking people to do things that they weren't supposed to do, but then you still see him as a hero, which is conflicting for me.
So it doesn't quite give us the details. His dad, I think, was some sort of soldier who killed soldiers for not obeying him in combat, and then one of his men turned on him for killing the others. That's my understanding of this weird origin story.
So there's that. And so I'm like, but you see him as a hero, which is very confusing. Confusing for me because I'm like, but then you question the entirety of everything you're doing, recognizing, I guess, at the end of this, that you're also a murderer too. So like it's come full circle almost. So like you did this, your dad and you are in the same boat and you recognize that the executioner would come for you as well. Like, I don't get it. Like, why?
So we also get the vibe that he didn't believe what like the official account was. And when he tried to find the truth, it was like buried. Oh, we also learned, by the way, he's from Oskaloosa, Kansas, which tells us a lot too, I think.
Yeah. It's a little crazy. I wish we got more still because you're right. I'd love to debate like why he feels this way about his dad and like if his dad should be considered a hero or not, but we don't even get like enough to really talk that out. And this is already, I think, the second time he's dying. He's kind of like Dakin where he just keeps like dying, but then coming back for reasons. There's still not a lot to chew on with Mr. Carl Denti.
He's got a teleporter. He can get out of there anytime.
Yeah, that's true. You got me.
But like now I want to be like, okay, I just need like a mini series of just him. Can we get the full story?
Yep.
From finish, not his thoughts and not like possible, you know, truths, things that may have been buried. Like, I want to see everything. I want to know so that I can make an informed decision about how I feel about this character because he's getting on my nerves.
Yeah, I mean, he's a villain. That's what's going on here. So there's a handbook. I was a handbook guy. I did not write this profile. There's a handbook called X-Men Earth's Mightiest Heroes. Let's pause here for just a second. The way the handbook writer summarized all this information just looking at the first paragraph of this character's biography. On his 12th birthday, Carl Dente was told his military father was killed by friendly fire. But after serving 10 years with the FBI, Dente learned his father was shot by his lieutenant for killing multiple soldiers under his command. In Dente's early 40s, when his FBI mentor and X-Men ally Fred Duncan died, he learned Duncan stockpiled advanced technology, secretly collected during his FBI and X-Men exploits. Inspired by the vigilante Punisher, Frank Castle, Dente used the weaponry to become the executioner in order to punish mutants. Duncan's files described as escaping justice. So that's the preamble it gives us in the handbook. Does that help tie any of it together? Not really.
Thanks for nothing, Chad.
I told you I hate this guy. We get a little bit more of him in Gambit still. In number 17, Valerie Cooper and the Committee on Superhuman Affairs sends Carl Dente to find Gambit, who has a contract out on his life. So Dente grabs Gambit, saving him from an attack from a villain by the name of, I'm not joking, Fireballs. But it turns out it's just Jack Farley, that other guy that Dente like once dressed up. It's Jack Farley in a new costume. So Jack Farley Fireballs is a guy out there in the Gambit Rogues Gallery. And then the Executioner shows up again, surprise! And it turns out that the new son, which is the alternate Gambit from another timeline, has obtained the Executioner armor. So in 18, we learned that Dente survived the space station explosion because he teleported free, but he had lost the Executioner armor. And now he works with Gambit, and there's this other Executioner running around, which is actually the new son in the armor. So they fight Fireballs, they fight Batroc and Zeron, the weapons master, and Crossbones, and Belladonna and the Thieves Guild is here, and the Executioner collapse a building on them. And in 19, Dente's like, oh, Gambit's a good guy. It takes him that long. In 21, Courier, who is a great queer Gambit character. This is the shape-changing guy that Mr. Sinister stole his shape-changing powers from, if you know this character at all. He posed as Charles Xavier, and he sets up a meeting with Dente at the Pentagon to get access to some of Dente's files on the Black Womb, because Fred Duncan is connected to that. I've got a whole Black Womb episode out there with Sarah Century and Anthony Oliveira, so pause here and go listen to that if you'd like to blow your brain with massive amounts of information. Then in 23, we have the Maximum Security event. Did you guys read comics back in Maximum Security?
Read all of these, but like going back, I think I like blocked them from memory because it gets so confusing.
This is where aliens decide that Earth is going to be a prison colony planet. So they just send all of the worst aliens in the world to Earth and then like put a shield around it. That's basically what you've got. There's an alien race called the Hethsa, H-E-T-H-apostrophe-S-A. So I told you, Nissi has to take some wide swings with this. So somehow Fred Duncan got the Executioner armor from the Hethsa and then brought it to Earth, and then Dente wears it, but then the new son steals it, and then the Hethsa get it back. The end forever, except not. Sean, do you want to describe this guy for us?
Sure. I think he shops at Marshall's. No, just kidding. He's a big, big macho pink guy. He's wearing like a yellow, it almost looks like a onesie over like green cargo pants. And he's got like brown boots up to his knees. He's definitely not a fashion guru. Let's just put it that way.
He's got some teeth.
I think it's interesting.
So after Hethsa initially approaches Gambit, he claims that the armor system of the Executioner has a database, quote, that contains information that may help your ecosystem slow down the growth of Ego. So, okay, part of the Maximum Security event is they've dropped Ego, the living planet, who is like slowly growing and covering Earth, which is like the big deadly threat they're trying to face and like stop in time. And Hethsa says that the data has been specifically collected by the High Evolutionary. Now, they run a schematic of a missile silo in the Oklahoma Plains. That's where the armor that Hethsa is seeking is there. And there's a group of heroes that accompany them, including Belladonna. We're not going to worry too much about it. So they scale into the place with Hethsa. There's a bunch of security systems. Hethsa is tracking the armor. They set off, or they disable a bunch more weapons. We get a line of like how Carl Dente was very likely using like federal funds to build this place. The armor, the executioner armor, is floating in like a lit up, like gravimetric stasis shell in front of like a row of a whole bunch of alien weapons. Apparently, this is connected to the military. Hetzel walks up and accesses the armor's memory archive, and it pops out looking like a CD. But Hetzel assures us no normal Terran computer will be able to read that. Hetzel then activates the armor's teleportation system and disappears. So Gambit puts on the executioner hood and is able to follow Hetzel through teleporting. So he ends up back in the middle of a prison riot where a bunch of Hetzel aliens are fighting the guards who are all dressed in executioner armor replicas. Gambit gets involved. He fights Hetzel directly. It says he uses the helmet scanning systems to look onto the temporal particles surrounding his quarry. Once he's located Hetzel, the helmet comes off. It felt awkward and smelt of ozone. Hetzel looks scared. His teeth are gnarly in this panel. Hetzel again had once failed to like intervene during a previous prison riot, and Hetzel attacks one of the executioner dressed guards, holds a gun to his head, and is recounting how he got exiled to Shi'ar Penitentiary. Gambit stops him from murdering the other guard. Gambit followed Hetzel by teleporting after him, and Hetzel has teleported, gone back in time to that original prison riot where he lost his freedom and got sent to the Shi'ar when he said he had that moment of cowardice. And when Hetzel wants to kill one of the guards who's dressed like the executioner, Gambit stops him, knowing that that would alter the timeline. So Gambit comes back. He admits that he's been time traveling. He now has the armor. He leaves Hetzel in the past. And then they leave the executioner armor sitting in that base. But then the helmet pulls off and the new sun was in it again. This is building up to the giant new sun conclusion. Weird story, guys. And this armor has some weird history that we've never really delved deep into, nor am I sure I want to. How you doing, Numa?
I have questions. Yeah. I have a lot of questions. Mostly, why? But no, in this, like this idea that like he's hodgepodging these things together, I think it's interesting, like in the sense of like, okay, he's gone, but like, I want to see that adventure for him, so I better understand like what he's like doing here. Because like, if the entire time we've been talking about how he's like found all these things because Duncan had them like, you know, stockpiled, but then like he goes off to another planet to get stuff or somehow finds this armor, like, and then like if he got it from Duncan, which is not, why now are they just coming to get it? Like, I don't know.
It's, I don't believe he has gone off planet except for the space station story. It seems like Duncan somehow acquired these either the alien armor or like components of the alien armor. Gambit volume 323, go read it. It's a weird one. And this character, you're just like, what the hell?
I think it's interesting this like this story of like explaining where some things come from, and like I think it's interesting that like he's like here to like get his stuff back. Essentially,
I got sent to prison on Earth, can I have my uniform back please? There's a bunch of mysteries about Duncan and the Black Womb Project and like this stockpile of alien weapons that are kind of weaving their way in and out of the Gambit stuff as well. Again, I wrote the Fred Duncan story. I think the right story can make all of this make sense, but it's just really hodgepodge until then. Sean, thoughts here?
Yeah, I agree. We need a Fred Duncan show. We need to know how Duncan and Denti are friends, what adventures they were going on. Like, that would be amazing.
Give me one 48-page annual and I will clear it all up.
Okay, all right. I'm here for it.
And then we jump to the modern era where Carl Denti is back. We're going to skip the other executioner for just a second. This is the Krakoan era. Jump to Marauders 5 and 6. Number one, I know you're a Marauders fan.
I love Marauders.
Carl Denti shows up in Marauders 5 and 6. Did you read this one?
I think I read part of this one. This is at the point when I was like trying to like figure out what was all going over with the X-Men at the time. But because I love Marauders, it's now 2020. The little creeps of the Hominis Verde are higher.
Do you remember the child version of the Hellfire Club a few years ago?
Yes.
They're Hominis Verendi.
Yes. Those little kids were the worst. I hate those little kids, actually. I'm sorry. This is going to be a really weird tangent. I despise them. I'm like, I teach children. And so like watching them run around, like do mischievous, evil things. I was like, I hate these children. They all need to be put in timeout. Where are your parents?
They're designing weapons of mass destruction, cloning Krakoa, and murdering rare animals.
things that kids do.
They hire the executioner to work with Hatemonger to attack the mutant marauders. And Carl, considering the company keep, he swiftly, very swiftly, gets his ass handed to him yet again. And this time it's definitely well deserved.
Sean, did you have a look at this one?
I've read this one, not recently though, but I do like that we see when he's actually with people stronger than him, he can't hold his own. Like, he's such a loser. By his own rules, he's a badass. But when he meets Hatemonger, he gets his ass handed to him.
Yeah, I don't know. He's a bizarre character. And then we also see him back in an X-Men Unlimited story, number 104, where he attacks a Dazzler concert. This is when we have the X-Men Unlimited Infinity comic.
Start off with more of that Carl thoughts. He says, mutants already control international politics and pharmaceuticals. Now you want to take our culture too? And I'm sick of gene trash making a mockery of our institution. And it's stomach churning watching real humans fall over themselves to applaud it. It ends now. Either execute, and execute is spelled the right way. It's not like X-C-U-T-E. That'd be execute though. You live on air for the world to see, or this bitch dies in your place. Make your choice, mutie. And Dazzler convinces the crowd to cheer for her, which powers her up. And he goes, stop it. You're cheering for the erasure of our culture. And Dazzler's like, I think they want to see your outdated bigotry get its in memoriam segment.
Dazzler cracking wise is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I love a good Dazzler getting attacked at her concert story, which there's a shocking amount of these. Jason Lowe just did that delicious Dazzler series where she gets attacked at multiple concerts.
But this has the crowd cheer to power up her power.
But this is a Steve Fox, Stephanie Williams story. It's cute. Executioner's acting like wildly out of character. He's just having a giant fucking tantrum. Okay, I'm going to share one fact with you that is very overlooked when it comes to this character. Again, I'm going to go back to that profile written about him. There's sections, and if it's written in the handbooks, it's considered canon unless the story contradicts it later. Under a section of education, it informs us that he has, quote, an MA in psychology from Syracuse University. Which is crazy. Huh.
So specific.
He's got a master's degree in psychology, and somehow that makes this character four times more frustrating to me. I'm also going to read his power section out loud here really quickly because it's an interesting summary. Height 6'1", weight 210 pounds. Carl Denti is intelligent enough to study, understand, and improve a variety of technology, even extraterrestrial. He's also a trained fighter with years of self-guided experience. As executioner, he carries a variety of power lances, including a Shi'ar Psylance, a Xenox energy weapon capable of piercing Colossus's armored hide, and another that ejects a projectile restraint gel similar to scroll restraints. His gloves release painful neurocharges on contact and contain wrist-mounted Shi'ar plasma slicer missiles. Executioner's Cirrus force field, Colfin prison guard helmet, and Shi'ar omnium mesh battle armor can withstand repeated superhuman strikes. His Xenox sensors can penetrate most terrestrial cloaking devices, while Sentinel Mark I bioscans pinpoint mutant locations and identify unique DNA. His Sidri cloaking device can fool most Earth technology, but does not disguise natural scent. Such a fun line to me. Executioner uses prototype Sentinel propol units for short flights and can piggyback through time and space via Colfin Stargate or by piggybacking on another system such as Cable's time travel technology. Executioner has access to other equipment such as brainwave-linked, laser-equipped anti-gravity drones, strength-enhancing gloves and boots, chest-mounted energy blasters, and handheld Stargate devices. Executioner maintains a secret sub-basement in Washington, D.C.'s FBI headquarters and formerly had bases in an Oklahoma missile silo and a space station near an unidentified black hole, which he accessed via Stargate. Guys, this is what we had to do when I worked on the handbooks. You take every appearance and write it all in one paragraph. What are your thoughts on this guy? This seems like one of those like product placement ads they would make them read like on America's Top Model Live just to watch them trip over the words.
I want to know more of is how does he have all this stuff? How does he have like a Stargate? How does he have a space station? Like, this was just a man who's working with the FBI, but yet he is like, he's got all this stuff. He's got more stuff than Magneto.
The other piece that's really interesting, and this is just a throwaway thing, during the 50 State Initiative, did you guys follow comics then, where they had a superhero, and there's a book where, again, this is handbook guys, Tony Stark is like considering potential recruits for the initiative, and Executioner's on the list. He's like, maybe I should recruit that guy.
Huh. Stupid. Tony.
No. Number one, how you feeling?
I disliked the idea of like the 50 state initiative. I hate this idea of like, oh, I'm recruiting heroes. I don't like it. But specifically, I didn't like the idea that like now we're recruiting people who A, are questionable and attacked my friends, but also like the dude is killing people. You can't recruit him. Like even if like they are questionable kills, like he's killing people. You can't make, no, that's not how this works. These people are supposed to be Avengers. Like, no.
So this is like, again, typical kind of like white nationalist energy in a way. We can look at this man's interior world if you want to. His dad died. He has a like cause of justice. He's educated in psychology. He's a trained FBI agent. In his mind, he's like, I don't know, just like super lonely and like wants to make the world a better place by killing mutant murderers. But he also has access to tremendous weapons and databases. Like he's got all these files. So he kills Tower. He goes after Mastermind and beats the X-Men, gets his ass handed to him by Storm, targets Emma Frost and fights Cyclops and Cable, targets Rogue and fights She and X-Men, targets Skin and gets his ass kicked, goes and like has all those crazy adventures with the Punisher. Then he has those like weird things in Egypt and like he powers up those guys, including fireballs, to go after Gambit. He captures Rogue and sets a trap. His alien armor disappears and gets worn by the new sun. He teams up with Gambit and decides, oh, we're friends now. And then he like dies in a space station, except teleports back to Earth, somehow gets his armor back, attacks the mutants in Marauders, and then the Dazzler concert. And that's kind of his whole thing. When we sum it up in one little paragraph like that, he's kind of pathetic.
Yeah. And yes. I love the way you recap stuff and somehow make it sound even more ridiculous than it originally was in its own context.
I guarantee we have not seen the last of this man. Which X-Man, and we're going to talk about the other executioner too, but which X-Man do you most want to fight him? Like, who does this guy deserve to have his ass kicked by? Wolverine would be, that'd be a fun battle.
I feel also like when you, if you were to pit them two against each other, I think that it would be a very telling story for him because like the man is out of his depth for the most part. And like, yes, Storm is obviously going to be a problem for him. Most of the other characters are a problem for him, but like giving him like a real threat and seeing how he like assesses where he stands. I would love to see the like internal monologue he has going up against someone like Wolverine, but also like my thought is to like, does he avoid these, you know, heroes or these people that he knows are way out of his league? Like, is he very specific in choosing his victims in a sense of like, or his interactions because he thinks that he can handle himself?
Do you know who I want him to get his ass kicked by more than anyone is Kitty Pryde. Like she just phases through his tech and then he just like, you know, drops him in the ground. Like he's done.
Yep. And she's a ninja.
There you go.
Then we have one more executioner, and this guy is somehow worse than the first one. In X-Men Gold 7 and 8, and then again in issue 35, this is a weird era. There's a bunch of weird concepts. I recently interviewed Mark Guggenheim, the writer of this series. Mm-hmm. We talked about some of the weird turns. This is where, like, gay Pyro and, like, the other Avalanche, and there's a weird bad guy named Cleavis, who's just a gay alien monster guy.
Yeah, like a random Brotherhood shows up of just, like, randos.
He's trying to take the stuff and spin it just a little bit. But this executioner, if you thought Carl Denti was bad, this guy's a fucking asshole.
So the new executioner stalks the X-Men for a time and then begins killing the students. The X-Men find corpses as the executioner freed the prisoners and Cleavis. Then he beats the shit out of Eyeboy.
Like knocks one of his eyes out. And there's like children corpses that the X-Men are like walking down the hall and like, oh, here's our dead child student. Who's doing this?
Terrible. Yeah, and it definitely brings up what Num One mentioned earlier. Like, Eyeboy is like a really lame mutant. Like, he doesn't really have a lot of defensive abilities. So, picking on Eyeboy, that sucks.
At least at the time.
I love Eyeboy, though. I might be like one of those like randos that I love the like the weirder student mutants. Like, I love Maggot. I love Eyeboy. All of the like Beak and Angel. Like,
Leah Williams made me love Eyeboy, but that was a few years later.
At first, when he appeared, I was like, what is this thing that we are doing here? But okay. But like, I actually love him. I love his dynamics with like Glob and all of the other like students. So like him like getting beat up is like, it's sad for me. Don't hurt him.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go into my hate voice. Muty. Gene joke. Disgusting. Because of your kind, my boy is dead. Wasn't even 10 years old. Never had a chance.
Then he plucks one of Eyeboy's eyes out with a knife. What? Gross.
That's dark. And then we get Shadowcat, Prestige, and Colossus attack. But he's wearing adamantium lace Kevlar, and he uses a power blocker. But Kitty, being a ninja, kicks his ass with a sword.
See, Kitty his can face... do it.
Yeah. You know, it was crazy seeing Kitty in the beginning of the Fall of the Mutants when she, like, took out that whole platoon of Orcus guards. Like, seeing her finally let loose, I was like, this bitch knows what's up. Get it, girl.
I was thinking actually, like, Death of Wolverine, and then, like, her actually, like, in the Kitty Pryde and Wolverine, like, miniseries, like, when she's, like, being trained as a ninja and stuff. I always, like, kind of forget about it, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. She can do these amazing things.
Yeah, she can be quite scary if she wants to be. When we finally see him unmask, we see his face is, like, all fucked up and, like, burnt, and he holds a gun on Kitty, and he's planted a bomb in the school. He says, this is the symbol of the evil of mutanity. This is the guy that's been murdering children. And this is where the school drops in, like, we get the flashback when the mansion dropped in the middle of Central Park, which is the thing that happened because the X-Men were living in Central Park at their mansion for a while.
Yep.
His wife and child were killed, he says. Sean, do you want to give us more of his monologue here?
Oh, you just like my hate voice.
I love it.
You fight like giants with the power of gods, and you don't care. You don't care about the ants who get trampled underfoot. How many evil mutants have you fought? How many times have you saved the world but never bothered to ask about the people lost to collateral damage?
And Kitty's like, yeah, I know we could be better, but she's like, but what you're doing is premeditated, you fucking asshole. It's deliberate. Like, you're murdering fucking kids. That makes you more evil than I will ever be. So he tries to kill her, he hits Colossus, and then Rockslide just beats the shit out of him, and they stop the bomb from blowing up, and he's arrested. But he's back at the end of the series in number 35. He's got something called an atomizer gun, and he tries to, like, stage it in a crowd, but, like, Kitty and Nightcrawler defeat him pretty quickly. So if you thought that first executioner guy was the first one's still worse because he's so complicated. This guy's just this guy's just an evil murderer that needs to go to jail. Okay, so Carl Denti with the, like, FBI vigilante balance shit, it's so much to reckon with. It's exhausting. It's a really rough story to try to make sense of. So we got two executioners, and I guarantee it's not the last. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw the executioner in a book in, like, the next 2 or 3 months. We're in this, like, new era of X-Men comics, so we can only bring this up to date to hear. What's left for you with this guy? What do you want to know? What are the things, like, the holes that you definitely need filled in besides the Fred Duncan origin story? Is there a story about this guy that you need? Do you even like him?
I don't, like, hate him. I like the idea of this kind of, like, mutant hunting vigilante kind of thing, just for story purposes. Not saying that, like, this is what I need in my life as, like, plot moving forward, but, like, I don't know, because it's so complex and so complicated and nothing is explained kind of linearly, I need to better understand him before I can say, yeah, I hate it or I love it. I don't like villains in general. I prefer heroes. So, like, anytime he's getting his ass handed to him, I'm like, good job, everyone. Again.
I do think he serves somewhat of a unique place in the X-Men. This idea of, like, the human guy who puts on armor and is, like, serial killing mutants. That's a story we get in a lot of superhero stories, right? But, like, for the X-Men, I do think there's a unique energy about him. Donald Pierce builds robots and Cameron Hodge turned himself into a transmode monster. Like, we have a lot of bigots, but this guy wants to get his hands dirty. I don't know. There's an interesting bend there. Sean, thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think I really like Executioner, but like Num One says, I'll agree. Like, he deserves his place in X-Men. He fills a role that we need of, like, the extremist taking matters into their own hands. I do want to see more of his backstory, but I think you got me thinking, like, I want to see Iceman fight Executioner. I think that'd say a lot in, like, you know, the queer character taking out the nationalists. Like, I don't know, that'd be really cool. And it'd be cool to see him, like, have the upper hand with Iceman, and then Bobby just kind of pulling himself together and being like, ah, gotcha, and then just take him out.
Which executioner would win in a fight?
I think the second one.
I don't know. I think that's a good question. Part of me wants to say the first one, just because, like, he's had a little bit more experience, I think. Like, he's run around and been around more, like, and been in more fights, like, with the Punisher and, like, running around and doing other things. But I think the ruthlessness of the second would maybe come out on top.
Carl Denti does have a code of ethics. That's one thing we got to say about that guy. Like, he kills Tower with just a blast. He doesn't want people to suffer. murderer. You know, he'll arm up people and he'll question his stuff. But this other guy is like murdering kids and like gouging eyeballs out with knives. It's like a really rough story. I hate the second one more. Like, let that guy burn in hell. The only thing I want with Carl Denti is the Fred Duncan story. That's all I want. I just want, I want Fred Duncan's story to matter. And Carl Denti is part of that, which is a weird connection. That Gambit series goes all over the place. The Punisher series is an interesting read, but mostly this is just a silly X-Men 90s villain who does have a huge glow up with X-Men 97, where we get characters like Executioner and Bastion making it to the big time in that incredible cartoon. This is the guy that again depowers Storm. As we're wrapping up, do you guys have any final thoughts or questions? And where can people find you both online? And is there anything you want to plug? We're going to put this out in the very first day of January.
So once again, this is Num1. You can follow me on Instagram at Num1Cosplay. I don't have a lot going on. I'm taking a little bit of a break with, you know, cons and things, but you'll still see me posting all over Instagram and sharing new cosplays and stuff. Final thoughts on Executioner. I feel like anytime he shows up, he should get beat up just on principle.
And my name is Sean Perrette. You can find me on Instagram and TikTok. You can also find my podcast, Solving for X, an X-Men Task podcast. We're currently doing X-Men Evolution with our newest third host, Ryan Iorio, and Kevin and myself. Last week, we actually released Two Mutants to Handle, which Chad so nicely dedicated his voice to for us. He was a Shatterstar and the camera person. The idea of Two Mutants to Handle is basically, what if Mojo took the X-Men and put them in a dating show, like Too Hot to Handle? Funniness ensues. So check that out on our podcast.
It's delightful to hang out with you both this morning.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.